that strep triggers autoimmune responses in the body that create these neurological issues. Medical research and science have found that prior to the onset of PANDAS, children often experience a strep infection, sometimes in the form of a fever with rash, so then it's automatically assumed that strep is the trigger. The only real connection between strep and these symptoms is that both can be found in some children. Strep can also be found in children without these symptoms. When it is present, it's a co-infection. And two other very important factors that go ignored are really behind children's struggles in this area. PANDAS is, in truth, a viral infection, because only viruses can create a factor that can be responsible for OCD, tics, spasms, and twitching. Neurotoxins. When strep is present at the same time, it's merely a co-infection to a virus. It's not the strep causing the neurological symptoms, nor is the strep triggering an autoimmune response that creates the symptoms. Neurotoxins are the cause, and strep cannot produce a neurotoxin. Even if strep created any kind of brain inflammation, that could not cause tics, spasms, twitches, and OCD. Only viral neurotoxins can. When PANDAS develops in little ones, it's because they were exposed to a large amount of mercury at roughly the same time they were developing a viral infection. One of the main viruses responsible for PANDAS is HHV6 and its many mutations. HHV7 causes a smaller percentage of cases, shingles an even smaller percentage, and lastly, EBV, though it's not as commonly the cause. Mostly HHV6 is the cause, and it's having a feeding frenzy on a child's mercury exposure, wherever that mercury came from. Early medical treatments could be harboring mercury, and a child could be born with mercury deposits in the liver inherited through the family line. With the combination of the virus plus mercury, a near explosion occurs. As the virus feeds on mercury, it releases an extremely elevated degree of neurotoxins. When these neurotoxins rush up to the brain, they immediately saturate neurotransmitter chemicals, short-circuiting electrical impulses, and that's what can cause obsessive-compulsive symptoms, tics, spasms, switches, and even difficulty communicating. Strep infections happen to be nearby because strep takes advantage of a lowered immune system. Strep is not only the cofactor to EBV, as you've heard earlier in the audiobook. It's also cofactor to HHV6, the very cause of most PANDAS cases. It's classic for the medical industry to blame it all on strep and the body attacking itself, though. It would be a little more fitting if the industry blamed PANDAS on strep and mercury, which is instead avoided. It would be completely accurate if the industry blamed PANDAS on HHV6, feeding on mercury, creating a neurotoxin. The rashes associated with PANDAS come from dermatoxins also exploding from the virus, as HHV6 has a feeding frenzy on mercury. They're viral toxins that surface to the skin, so the rashing that medical communities associate with strep is not really strep-related. By the way, scarlet fever is not bacterial either. It's also viral. That scarlet fever is caused by strep is another mistake of the medical industry. In truth, it's another version of HHV6 or even early onset EBV, feeding off a child's large deposits of mercury in the liver or elsewhere in the body and releasing neurotoxins and dermatoxins that cause the scarlet rash. The medical establishment does know that roseola is viral. HHV6 and sometimes HHV7 are the true causes. Unlike with scarlet fever and PANDAS, medicine is not focused on strep infection with roseola, though it is actually there as a co-infection too, just much milder and not enough to come through in testing. Children can still experience tics, jerks, spasms, and OCD along with a heavy roseola rash, because it's a virus behind all of them, creating neurotoxins and dermatoxins. It just so happens that with PANDAS, medical research and science are focused on strep, which is merely a co-infection and not the cause or trigger of the neurological symptoms. For PANDAS to develop, a child must have high mercury in the body from some source or another. If mercury weren't there, chances are the viral explosion would not have erupted so early in the child's life. It would have been saved for down the road, taking the form of another viral illness that's covered in the Medical Medium series. The truth is in the liver. Inherited liver problems can follow us into adulthood. For many of us, the liver problems we experience in adult life started out as baby or child liver. Let's be clear that this inheritance is not genetic. It's a passing down of poisons and pathogens, both from the father at conception and from the mother throughout the baby's development. A baby's liver has a lot to do with a mum's liver. When a mum's liver and reproductive system are high in heavy metals such as nickel, cadmium, aluminium and lead, a developing baby's liver can take them on. Also, when a mum's liver is stagnant, it creates that dirty blood from chapter 10 that's not gauged with any scientific model, because medical research and science have not yet caught on to this type of blood toxicity. When the mum has dirty blood and the baby gets nutrients for development through the umbilical cord, they'll be coupled with higher levels of toxins. Since the mum's liver isn't filtering blood properly in this case, the baby's liver will become a filter for it. In the process, the baby's liver will take on some of those toxins. None of this is the mother's fault. It's not her fault that industries created toxic chemicals and fueled viruses and bacteria that we find ourselves exposed to in everyday life. It's not her fault that she didn't learn in school how or why to care for her liver. It's not her fault that doctors don't know how to test for sluggish liver and dirty blood and how to clean them up. It's not her fault that paediatricians aren't given the training to get to the root of babies' and children's mystery digestive, skin, and other conditions. It's not the father's fault either, or the doctor's. Say it with me. It's not your fault. What's important is that finally you know where the truth lies, and that truth is in the liver. Your liver, your baby's liver, your child's liver. These are precious jewels to guard with your life. And now you have the tools to protect them. Chapter 29. Autoimmune Liver and Hepatitis. When illness affects the liver and doesn't ring any of the normal alarm bells that help doctors identify what's wrong, or when the liver doesn't respond to treatment, it leaves behind the classifications of hepatitis A, B, C, D, or E, and doctors often diagnose it as a mysterious autoimmune situation. It's a prime example of how chronic illness gets misunderstood and the mistaken autoimmune theory gets employed. Some doctors who think outside the box sometimes label this mystery situation as autoimmune hepatitis, believing that even though it isn't an easily identifiable form, it hasn't completely left the realm of hepatitis. They're onto something. Any liver inflammation that gets called autoimmune still has everything to do with hepatitis. Liver inflammation. With any inflammation of the liver, diagnosis is a grey area. There's no magic button you can press to determine which letter of the hepatitis alphabet you should get. Blood work doesn't separate them out, because what blood work really tests are liver enzyme and bilirubin levels to see whether there's liver dysfunction, possible antibodies present, and white blood cell count to see whether there's a blood disorder, and, overall, whether any inflammation is present. If elevated counts of the killer cells and other lymphocytes, as well as basophils, neutrophils, monocytes, or tests for immunoglobulin, IgG, indicate a new infection or post-infection of some kind, that's not enough to distinguish among the different types of hepatitis, so you move on to the next test. When the doctor presses on the liver, does it feel like it hurts? Is the liver area tender? If the answer is no, then as the doctor stands there palpating the area, she or he will be perplexed and maybe start to rule out the possibility of hepatitis A, B, C, D, or E. The third test is what the liver looks like when imaged through an MRI, CT scan, PET scan, or ultrasound. Does it show scar tissue, cell damage? Is there a mass, an obstruction? These questions all factor into a hepatitis diagnosis, or non-diagnosis. With everything they factor together, you're still not going to get a diagnosis that's 100% transparent and correct. If the liver inflammation someone is experiencing has been long-term and is acute in that moment, plus a scan shows that there's not a lot of scar tissue, then it may be classified as hepatitis A. If the inflammation is short-term and acute, and accompanied by a slight fever, tenderness in the area, and an elevated white count, it could get a hepatitis A diagnosis. If someone's condition seems more chronic, with longer-term inflammation that's not acute, a little more scar tissue damage showing up on an MRI, CT scan, PET scan, and either elevated or low, weakened white count accompanied once in a while by a very mild fever and some off-and-on pain in the abdomen, it could be classified as hepatitis B. If someone's scan reveals more damage, injury or scar tissue in the liver, like a fibrosis or a mild cirrhosis, and elevated liver enzymes in the blood work, show what appears to be long-term inflammation, while antibodies show evidence of a possible past infection or elevated white count, it could be diagnosed as hepatitis C. And if the liver exhibits extensive chronic damage with fibrosis and cirrhosis in various parts of the liver and mild non-cancerous lesions, as well as chronic inflammation and swelling, plus bilirubin issues and extremely elevated enzymes, then the diagnosis will most likely be hepatitis D, with a hepatitis B background. Again, these are just conditions of the liver being eyeballed, with theories behind the eyeballing. It's rare in chronic illness that you ever get a straight answer that's right. Finally, chances are you'll get a hepatitis E diagnosis if you walk into the doctor's office experiencing a persistent fever, acute abdominal pain on the right side, weakness, and extreme fatigue, as well as elevated liver enzyme and bilirubin tests, a CT scan, PET scan, MRI or ultrasound that detects inflammation, and you've been travelling extensively. If you haven't been travelling, those factors could initially lead to a hepatitis A diagnosis. Though if you become sicker and it can't be tamed, then the diagnosis could change to hepatitis E. See how there's no hepatitis A virus, hepatitis B virus, hepatitis C virus, hepatitis D virus, or hepatitis E virus, that determines each classification. Diagnosis is all based on the guesswork of interpreting symptoms, external examination, imaging, and indirect blood test results. Some of the other usual indicators a doctor looks for are flu-like symptoms, fever and jaundice, yellow in the eyes and skin tone. If nothing adds up to make textbook sense, then the patient's condition is usually thrown in the idiopathic, meaning unknown, pile of autoimmune liver disease with no hepatitis. Hepatitis A, B, C, D, and E are actually mysteries too. They're just labelled, which makes them seem better understood than they are. The miracle is that the medical system actually realises hepatitis is viral. That's a massive positive breakthrough. While there's not one separate virus for each, which is how they conceive of it now, there is a virus involved. That it's only one virus is unknown to medical research and science as of today, even though with those hepatitis virus labels, they make it sound, even to doctors, as though they've singled out one virus for each letter. The truth is that they've identified variations in symptoms, not different viruses. Medicine has no proof that there are five separate hepatitis viruses, and they don't even know which virus is involved. Diagnosis bias. The most common information you'll hear about hepatitis C is that you can have it for decades and not develop problems until later down the road. That if you're worried you have it, you can run to your doctor to get an easy Hep C test, and that 1 in 30 adults will eventually be diagnosed with hepatitis C. This is a misleading and incomplete understanding about what's happening inside someone's liver. Let's break it down a bit. First, that easy test is not so clear-cut. It's the same collection of diagnostics we've already examined. How does the liver look in an ultrasound, CT scan, PET scan, or MRI? How's the blood work? Are there elevated liver enzymes? And so on. None of this identifies a so-called hepatitis C virus. If they were looking for a specific virus, they'd be stuck because they don't know what virus to look for yet. The viral concept is only a theory, a good theory in this case, yet not a fully developed, proven answer. Even when they show images of what they've pinned down under the microscope, they don't understand it. It's part of where they go wrong with understanding hepatitis C and the other hepatitis varieties. Some more on diagnostics. After the blood test and the hands-on check for tenderness, there's the imaging. If there are visible cysts or tumours, or if the organ's enlarged, they'll often order a biopsy to collect some tissue and examine it for damaged, scarred liver cells or cancer cells. If cancer is ruled out, not a lot of inflammation is present. Blood work seems relatively normal, and only benign cysts are present. There won't be a hepatitis C diagnosis. On the other hand, for some doctors, even one test coming back positive is a yes for hepatitis C, because the condition is trending. The slightest dysfunction of the liver, and you could land yourself a hepatitis C diagnosis with a snap of the finger before your doctor has even had a second cup of coffee for the morning. An exception is when there's degenerated liver tissue. If scarring or fibrosis is detected, patients will likely face the question of how much alcohol they imbibe. If they answer that they drink in quantity pretty regularly and that they've done so long term, they'll likely be ousted from the hepatitis C diagnosis and thrown into the category of cirrhosis. The grey area here is vast. If the person exhibiting liver symptoms drinks martinis and other cocktails on weekends only, she'll be told she has hepatitis C, while the person who drinks a few beers every night will hear he has cirrhosis. That's a subjective measure. If medical research and science had really identified the hepatitis viruses, they'd be able to test for them and make a real, accurate, definitive conclusion in each person's case instead of being stuck in the guessing game of grey area theories. There would be no grey area. A diagnosis wouldn't be eyeballed based on lifestyle. That's not how diagnosis works, though. In the medical industry, hepatitis C is a grade, not an identification. It's a partisan disease. The same keeping you in a box thinking happens when you've used drugs. If symptoms develop like a mild fever, an achy liver area, and elevated enzymes, plus you have a history of recreational drug use, rather than prescription drug use, you'll likely be given a hepatitis B or C diagnosis and told it's the unclean lifestyle that's to blame, rather than the non-hepatitis diagnosis that a non-drug user with the same symptoms would get. Even if that other person uses prescription drugs regularly, they may not get a hepatitis diagnosis. It's subjective. And here's another older medical misstep. If you experience a bit of discomfort in your liver area, a little inflammation shows up in an MRI or ultrasound, and your blood work shows slightly elevated liver enzymes or an imbalanced white blood count, and you're also gay, your symptoms will likely be diagnosed as hepatitis A, B, or C. While someone with the exact same symptoms who wasn't gay would possibly receive no hepatitis diagnosis. Because once again, medical communities are not identifying a virus that allows them to definitely identify what's really happening. Doctors' training in the earlier days taught them to factor people's sexual orientations into their diagnoses. I've seen these biased diagnoses happen to many people over the years, and the bias is not talked about in the wider world. While it may not occur today as much as it did 15 or 30 years ago, it does still unfairly exist. With drug use, the truth is that just as many people who live what's called a clean lifestyle get sick livers as those who struggle with drug addiction. Any kind of drugs, whether recreational or prescription, weaken the immune system. If you're a patient who has been prescribed 10 drugs for various conditions, painkillers, sleeping pills, antidepressants, antipsychotics, blood pressure medication, diabetes medication, and so on, the liver is going to face just as much of a challenge as the liver of someone shooting up street drugs. With lowered immune responses, you'll both be just as susceptible to viral infection. The difference is that the heroin addict is going to be told she has hepatitis B or C, even if she swears she uses brand new needles with each use because she's OCD about germs. The doctor may not trust her. They call it a different virus based on what you're doing differently. What really causes hepatitis? So medical communities are taught that there are different viruses when it comes to the liver. The hepatitis A virus, the hepatitis B virus, the hepatitis C virus, the hepatitis D virus, and the hepatitis E virus. And they're almost right to believe it. There is a virus behind hepatitis, although it's only one virus with many different strains and mutations. That virus is none other than Epstein-Barr. The same virus that causes mononucleosis. The same virus that enlarges the spleen in many people who also have liver conditions. The same virus that I wrote a whole book about called Thyroid Healing, because it's at the root of thyroid conditions too. EBV purposefully likes to make a home inside the liver and can lie dormant there for years or even decades for many people. When practitioners say you could have had hepatitis C for ages and not known it, they're right. You can have EBV inside your liver for a lifetime before it rings the alarm bells in your body that alert your doctor to investigate. Throughout a person's life, EBV develops a relationship with her or his liver, an ongoing relationship, both fruitful and non-fruitful. In its early days, EBV was a beneficial virus that kept the immune system in gear. When the liver isn't taken care of, though, and a person's immune system isn't looked after and replenished, then, as you've heard throughout this audiobook, troublemakers can get inside and cause problems. When just the right stage is set, with adrenaline from hardships, prescription drugs, and not having the resources or teaching to eat right, then over time EBV can create damage to the liver that can eventually be seen through medical testing and diagnosed, often, as hepatitis. On the other hand, if you're eating right, caring for your body and liver, EBV can become helpless and stop causing harm so you can heal. So many people live throughout their whole lives with a low-grade viral condition of the liver that eventually leads to a diagnosis or a confusing non-diagnosis. Many people get diagnosed with hepatitis because of their viral livers. Hundreds of millions of people don't get any diagnosis, and they just walk around with a low-grade viral infection of the liver, never knowing what's causing their symptoms and other health problems. Not everyone with EBV automatically develops hepatitis. It's only certain varieties of the virus that, if left untamed and not taken care of right, can cause extensive damage to the liver. With hepatitis E, for example, it's a severe viral infection of a very aggressive EBV mutation that, for the most part, someone picks up from an outside source rather than living with it since childhood. Even in that extreme case, you can gain back control. The future of hepatitis. Until medical research and science zero in on EBV as the cause of hepatitis, which strain of EBV causes which variety of hepatitis, and how to detect EBV in the liver, not just the blood, they won't be able to improve their diagnostics. The differences among the different EBV strains and mutations that cause hepatitis A, B, C, D, and E, as well as autoimmune hepatitis, can be subtle. There are over 60 varieties of EBV, and some cause more liver damage than others if conditions are right, which still leaves a grey area. Add that to the condition of your immune system, how you take care of your body, what other pathogens and liver troublemakers you've inherited and been exposed to along the way, and the factors in your environment, and there's more subtlety that influences how one individual's case of hepatitis presents itself versus another's. Medical research and science will become more and more attuned to the differences among cases of hepatitis and keep expanding the hepatitis alphabet continually, as they see there's more to the liver condition than anyone expected. They'll keep seeing more and more mutations of EBV without realizing what they're seeing, and they'll keep adding on to the string of hepatitis letters, just as they've done with strep. As they keep adding letters to the hepatitis alphabet, it will only be evidence that medicine hasn't yet identified the real virus behind it all. If they did, they'd name it the proper herpetic virus it is, EBV. Remember that the letters assigned to hepatitis are just placeholder schematics for a condition that hasn't yet been discovered in full. Letters only identify different viral paths of disease inside the liver, not the virus itself, which to this day they have not identified, and they may never. Because if different types of hepatitis are tagged as different mutations of EBV, it will attract too much attention to this virus that they want buried and forgotten. EBV has a forensic trail that can incriminate a tremendous number of industries. Autoimmune liver. Let's put hepatitis aside for a moment. A viral liver doesn't only cause hepatitis. It can go in another direction instead. A viral liver plays a huge role in every autoimmune disorder there is. If you have celiac, RA, lupus, Lyme disease, PANDAS, sarcoidosis, rheumatic fever, mono, scleroderma, Sjogren's syndrome, type 1 diabetes, lichen sclerosis, vitiligo, ulcerative colitis, Graves' disease, Guillain-Barré syndrome, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, fibromyalgia, autoimmune hepatitis, Addison's disease, optic neuritis, stiff person syndrome, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, endometriosis, Crohn's disease, Castleman's disease, Raynaud's syndrome, restless legs syndrome, interstitial cystitis, juvenile arthritis, MS, Meniere's disease, ME/CFS, polyglandular syndrome or any other autoimmune condition or disease, the virus that's really responsible resides in your liver. We're told instead that these are all instances of the body attacking itself. That's not the case at all. Your body is always on your side and would never turn against you. These symptoms and conditions are very real, though, and they're all signs of a viral activity. No matter what autoimmune issue you have, there's a virus behind it, and one of that virus's homes in your body is your liver. Different viruses and different viral strains and different viral fuels cause different autoimmune illnesses and symptoms. So a viral liver doesn't automatically translate to hepatitis. A viral liver could take a completely different form, one that doesn't even show much evidence in the liver. No matter what the virus or the problem it's causing, though, if you take care of your liver in light of the realization that it's harboring pathogens, you're on the road to doing something about your autoimmune issue, rather than living in fear of what your body could do to you next. Your body loves you unconditionally. Spleen inflammation. People who develop enlarged spleens without a physical injury are dealing with a viral condition too. Any kind of spleen sickness is viral, and there's only one virus family that causes spleen inflammation, the herpetic family. Every single type of herpes virus, ranging from simplex 1 to the undiscovered HHV-10, HHV-11, HHV-12, HHV-13, HHV-14, HHV-15, and HHV-16, and all their mutations, can inflame this organ. The most common virus behind spleen inflammation is EBV, and it's over 60 mutated strains. Oftentimes, anyone who has any kind of liver condition has also experienced some kind of spleen inflammation at some time in their life, whether they knew it or not. It could range from mild, going completely undiagnosed and diminishing on its own, to extreme, forcing an emergency splenectomy. If your liver condition reached a detectable stage, identified as either hepatitis or an idiopathic autoimmune condition, your spleen was most likely affected in some way by the same chronic viral infection causing the liver issue. Regaining control. Now you have control. Understanding what creates a liver condition, or a hepatitis diagnosis, or an autoimmune liver, or even an inflamed spleen, you can either get blindsided at the doctor's office 10, 20 or 30 years from now, or you can clean up your liver right now in life and completely avoid a liver condition, or heal and reverse the hepatitis or other liver condition you already have. That's the force of knowledge. To move forward. It's all about taming viral activity, knowing what's really going on now, instead of falling prey later, to not knowing how to protect yourself the way you need to can mean everything. Chapter 30. Cirrhosis and liver scar tissue. When we hear the term cirrhosis of the liver, we often get a stigmatic image of a person who's lived an unclean life related to alcohol or drug abuse. This isn't how we should view the condition. Yes, it's true that alcohol and drug addictions are often catapults to liver disease. As you heard in the previous chapter, when a virus is present in the liver, drug and alcohol abuse can lower the immune system so that the virus can take advantage. Their abuse can also do its fair share of slowly injuring the liver over time. The combination can create scar tissue that begins the process of liver damage. Keeping our focus on condemning certain folks for their struggles, though, not only prevents us from lending them compassion, it distracts us from a dirty secret. Pericirrhosis. Let's give the medical world the benefit of the doubt on this one and say that the reason this secret hasn't been unveiled is because medicine doesn't know either that millions of people, over a billion globally, walk around with what I call pericirrhosis, a condition that may take decades for medical science to discover. This is a transition period before cirrhosis that can occur subtly in various tiny spots in the liver and go unnoticed long term. Drug and alcohol use is everywhere. A huge part of the population drinks, and a huge part of the population takes prescription drugs. Not to mention that most of us have viruses in the liver. Pericirrhosis can happen for that person who has a glass of wine every other night and eats too much steak, or has been on prescription medication for 20 years. And in many cases, pericirrhosis and cirrhosis don't even happen as a result of drug or alcohol damage to the liver. Many more people are on the edge of pre-cirrhosis than anyone realizes. Pre-cirrhosis is a condition starting to get some recognition in medicine. It's a mild, early form of cirrhosis that's visible in imaging. Pericirrhosis occurs at a much earlier stage and is not yet detectable by medical scans. Should everyone just be condemned and live with the stigma? The signs of pericirrhosis are not in plain view at your doctor's office, especially since it's not a documented condition yet. So physicians aren't given the tools to detect it. With any liver condition, because the organ is so good at preserving through struggles, the signs don't often show themselves early, given the limits of today's technology for testing and examining the liver. Imagine you're driving down the road. You can't get lost, since your car's computer or your personal device can easily provide direction. The gauge on the dashboard will keep you updated on your fuel level. You can check your personal device if you want to know the forecast, and your car's thermometer tells you the temperature in the moment. If a tire starts to lose air, the sensor will alert you. Now, what if all these warnings were gone? You'd have no gas gauge to tell that you were running low on fuel, no idea of what the weather could bring, no sense of direction, not even a paper map in the glove compartment like in the old days, and no signal if air was starting to escape one of your tires. What if your oil stick even went missing so you couldn't tell how much oil was in the engine? You'd be driving blind, aimlessly wandering until finally something, a flat tire, a dead end, an overheated engine, a blizzard, stopped you. That's the state of the liver in today's medical research and science. As you heard in Chapter 9, the current state of liver testing is merely guess testing. There's no reliable means of detecting trouble until you wake up one morning with a problem. An acute attack of pain on the right side of your abdomen, and some nausea, and you're off to the doctor, where an MRI, CT scan, PET scan, or ultrasound could reveal extensive damage that's been building up for years. With the limits of modern equipment and the limits of modern understanding of the liver, they couldn't have caught it back when it was still at an early stage, when it was still pericirrhosis and hadn't stopped you in your tracks. The liver's not an important part of the medical world's agenda right now. It's sitting on the back burner. So, looking for very early phases of disease in the liver is not considered important. That's why you have to take matters into your own hands when it comes to your health. This is your body and your life that you're protecting. When you're living with hidden liver damage, it comes down to that one lightning bolt in a storm that can finally split the old oak tree down the middle, showing us the rot that had been spreading inside for decades. When liver damage is building, one more of anything can overload the organ and push it too far. That's life for someone with pericirrhosis. Is one more of this or that going to be the strike that finally causes it to break down? We use the expressions, "Don't be so hard on your friend," and "Don't be so hard on yourself." We should be telling each other, "Don't be so hard on your liver." Throughout our lives, we're given prescription drugs to help our problems. Meanwhile, they can create their own problems if we aren't careful. If you're taking medications that you were prescribed by a well-meaning doctor who understands the full scope of your health, that's rightfully so. You don't deserve to live with aches and pains and anxiety and the other symptoms that cause doctors to reach for their prescription pads. When you're on medication, you do have to be a little gentler with your liver in other ways to balance it out. If at the same time you're taking pharmaceuticals, you've also got an overload of toxins inside your liver and a low-grade viral liver infection, like almost everyone has. And then you have a few too many social drinks, that could tip the balance. The liver trouble may not be as quickly evident as for someone who's addicted to and abusing alcohol. What it will be is a slower progression headed to the same place in the end. Scar tissue in the liver. Cirrhosis is a process of liver cells becoming damaged faster than they can be rejuvenated. Plain and simple. Millions of Americans alone have scar tissue in the liver. People's lives, situations, and circumstances can vary in the whole process. When someone's liver is stagnant from holding on to too many toxins, that's one way for scar tissue to form. In many cases, an elevated inflammatory reaction happens due to one or more viruses inside the liver. If an aggressive virus or bacterium that's not easy to neutralize escapes past the white blood cells assigned to the liver's portal vein and hepatic artery, the pathogen can avoid becoming incarcerated, using its freedom to cause trouble. The Epstein-Barr virus, for example, can roam the halls of school without a hall pass, slowly making mischief and causing its own variety of scar tissue, which is off the radar of medical communities. Liver scar tissue builds up chronically when liver cells aren't rejuvenating in enough time before the next round of instigators appears, whether they're from toxic food, toxic substances in the bloodstream, pesticides, or other chemical exposure, prescribed medication or the like. For many people, it won't be until the liver is fully loaded with troublemakers, that is, poisons and pathogens, before scar tissue can be diagnosed at the doctor's office. In all cases that aren't alcohol or drug abuse related, they'll never know what's really causing the scarring. The microadhesions I mentioned in Chapter 6, Your Purifying Liver, can contribute to the liver scarring I'm talking about here, though only when the liver's state of overload gets out of hand.
While those natural microadhesions are created as a protective measure to wall off a controllable level of poisons, when the liver is pushed to a certain point, viruses and highly toxic troublemakers can also create their own microadhesions or even lesions. When the liver is dealing with this kind of rapid cell death, it goes into survival mode. Healthy liver cells cannot exist in danger zones, so the liver must protect you and itself by walling off whole areas that have become too filled with too many toxins, as when an entire radiation zone is walled off, or when a submarine springs a leak and a compartment must be sealed off, even with people trapped inside. The life of the liver must back off from these areas that have lost their vitality. It must go beyond its natural process that it needs to function and operate instead at an out-of-control level, because what's coming at it is out of control. It groups together whole areas of microadhesions and more scar tissue forms. Luckily, the liver also has a built-in safety mechanism. More protective measures. Protective membranes run through and across our livers. These thin, fine, delicate strips act as barriers so that the entire liver does not become injured at once. It's unknown to medical research and science that the liver tries to keep, for example, pesticide damage to one area of the liver so one exposure won't flood the entire organ in a wave. The membranes are living walls that adapt, learning how to close themselves off at the right moments so troublemakers don't get to cross the liver on the easy route. Think of one of those classic stories from elders about trips to school in the old days, walking 7 miles in the cold and snow with holes in their shoes, books in their arms, no gloves, walking hours out of their way because of a farmer's high fence that they had to walk around. That's the goal of these microscopically thin membranes, to make troublemakers take the long way so they don't all hit at once. Or think of them as levees that hold back the poisons as long as they can. This is why cirrhosis occurs quietly and slowly, and only in some areas of the liver at a time. The liver's built-in safety mechanism of these membranes allows the rejuvenation of cells to continue in certain areas while other areas are being damaged. Otherwise, the whole liver would become pickled at once. This is also why blood alcohol takes a bit of time to rise when someone is drinking. The membranes keep the alcohol partitioned at first so that the liver doesn't become saturated in one go. As the alcohol takes the long way round, and if someone drinks more and more of it throughout the night, more areas of the liver become more saturated. A dose of compassion. When people have scars on the outside, they're always looking for that magic ointment that will heal them faster. No one even wants a blemish or a wrinkle. They'll go to incredible ends to figure out what to put on the skin. In truth, it's dirty blood on the inside that keeps scars from healing. When it's toxic and filled with poisons, like from drinking too much alcohol, oxygen doesn't get to the deep level of the derma where scar tissue lies, which limits the body's ability to mend scars from beneath. Everybody's trying to heal the skin's scar tissue from above, when it's the liver they should be tapping into to mend the skin. In the liver, it's all inside and out of reach, and so the healing must all be done from within. Dirty blood can similarly prevent the healing of internal scar tissue, and since dirty blood comes from an overburdened liver, If you don't take care of your liver, it's hard to heal the scar tissue. This is when good, natural, cleansing antiviral food really does matter. Pushing pathogenic invaders out to an area of the liver where the armed guards, white blood cells, of the liver's immune system can tag the virus for destruction or capture, or even push virus cells out through a flush-like technique to be caught by adjacent white blood cells that roam the borders of the liver, that's a big step toward healing. The powerful antivirals that you'll hear about in Chapter 37 can give you just the boost you need. You also need antioxidants for healing scar tissue, because they essentially stop your liver from dying. There are antioxidants in fruits and vegetables that haven't even been discovered by research and science yet that are critical for softening scar tissue and bringing back the liver. If you keep your fats low and bring in the most important foods to heal your liver, you can stop the progression of pericirrhosis or even cirrhosis. The saying, knowledge is power, couldn't be more true, especially when it comes to living with a condition that isn't shown enough compassion. Come back to this chapter when you need to remember what's really going on inside your body so that you can truly move forward. Chapter 31. Liver Cancer. You're going about your life when out of nowhere you develop a symptom that sends you to the doctor's office, or you're at a routine checkup and your doctor recommends a CT scan, PET scan or MRI. A mass is spotted in your liver. The first thing you're going to ask is, how did this happen? In other words, where did it come from? Is it lifestyle, hereditary, chance? Why me? Why cancer? Why now? If your physician is a liver expert, you'll likely get an answer that's close to reality and slightly productive. While so many medical truths remain undiscovered in this area, there's a truth rumour among doctors, and that's that viruses play a role in liver cancer. Doctors aren't certain. They don't have a guarantee. It's not an etched-in-stone theory. Still, to them, it's a possibility, because they're aware that problems such as hepatitis B and C are viral and can lead to cell damage and cancers such as hepatocellular carcinoma, HCC. There's an offshoot of HCC called fibrolamellar hepatocellular carcinoma, FHCC, that occurs more often in women. Viruses do indeed have a great deal to do with liver cancer, so there's a lot of hope that medical discovery around this will keep advancing in the right direction. The fuller truth is that liver cancer forms as a result of a virus fueling itself on toxins in the liver. Here's the equation. Virus plus toxins equals cancer. Not that every time you have a virus and toxins present in your body, cancer will form. It takes particular mutated strains of certain viruses to create cancer, and they won't go cancerous unless they have strong enough toxic fuel. The most common and dominant virus that creates liver cancer is Epstein-Barr virus, EBV, which you can read about in detail in Thyroid Healing. Again, only some mutated strains of its over 60 varieties can form cancer cells, and only when they consume a particularly strong brew of toxins. So having EBV does not automatically translate to developing cancer. Other viruses, such as HHV6, HHV7, the undiscovered HHV10, HHV11, HHV12, HHV13, HHV14, HHV15, and HHV16. Shingles varieties, cytomegalovirus and all their mutations and undiscovered strains can create a stir inside the liver that contributes to cancer. A virus's paradise. You'll hear that becoming ill has everything to do with lifestyle. Oftentimes, in alternative medicine especially, everything is simplified to belief systems, where if you don't eat this version of healthy or that version of healthy, or if you eat foods labelled bad, then something unfortunate is bound to happen. If they don't understand how cancer really works, though, how can they say what's healthy or unhealthy? If they don't know which foods viruses feed on, how can they say what will safeguard or doom you? They can't. Not with their current state of understanding, anyway. One of the biggest problems we have in medical research and science that has been passed down to healthcare professionals is a law written in stone: a virus cannot eat anything. This great mistake, a theory that's never been definitively weighed, measured, tested, and proven, has nonetheless been grandfathered in as a commandment. Believing this incorrect information holds us back from knowing how to stop certain liver diseases, such as cancer and even benign liver tumours and cysts. When medical research and science someday break this law that was paid for and invested in back in the old days, and finally allow new, brilliant scientists to open doors and study viruses properly, they'll discover that a virus does need food to stay alive and thrive. They'll find that all liver growths, no matter how large or small, cancerous or benign, need those two elements in order to form a virus, very often EBV, and food for that virus. For a virus, the liver is like a Garden of Eden. Tons and tons of delicious food are all around, and as long as it doesn't taste the one type of food that can kill it, that virus can flourish. Its fueling foods include compounds and agents from dairy products, lactose from dairy, proteins and fats from eggs, toxic heavy metals such as mercury, aluminium, lead, cadmium, nickel, steel, arsenic, and alloys inherited through the family line, solvents, insecticides and other pesticides, herbicides, old medicines such as antibiotics stored up for years, plastics, petroleum fuel, industrial chemical-laden oils, conventional household cleaners, and many more. They form an abundant smorgasbord of options. Then there are the forbidden foods, fruits, vegetables, leafy greens, certain herbs, tubers like potatoes and roots. If the virus feeds on any of those, there's a good chance it won't gain energy. With many of them, such as with any fruits, if the virus consumes some, it will even self-destruct. I know what you're thinking. It's not like the whole apple just ends up in the liver. Very true. It's digested and broken down in the digestive tract. Its phytochemical compounds extracted and assimilated in a godly way, and it's these that find their way through the bloodstream of the hepatic portal system to the liver. Forbidden foods, phytochemical compounds, are tempting to a virus. Some viruses, depending on the variety or strain, the ones that aren't so smart, will even take a crack at sampling them. That's right, different types and mutated forms of viruses have different intelligence systems. There are a lot of EBV varieties that will have a go at an apple's forbidden compounds, which have glucose and what I call hyperantioxidants attached. Hyperantioxidants are an undiscovered variety of supercharged antioxidants, amplified to kill bugs such as viruses inside the body. When these curious strains of EBV and other viruses such as HHV6, as well as bacteria, sample that apple by absorbing the food through their cell structure. They choke and die. Smarter viruses, like others in the EBV family and the herpatic family in general, ignore the apple and other fruit compounds and move on to the foods they know will fuel them. Some very intelligent virus varieties won't even hang around the liver when it's clear someone is consuming enough fruit. They'll run from those hyper antioxidants and will try to find fuel in other parts of the body. When the virus cells travel, they expose themselves to eager white blood cells in the liver that identify and destroy them. In this way, hyper antioxidants indirectly stop viruses as well. If it's only one apple a month that someone's eating, Mr. Intelligent Cancer-Causing Virus will happily stay and just avoid that single apple. Here in paradise, Mr. Virus and his family are finding abundant resources with which to build a home for themselves. Those building materials are the liver tissue cells, which Mr. Virus fabricates and manipulates by poisoning some with toxic byproduct and turning others cancerous, using them to construct his perfect habitat. In order to do all this, both to have the energy to build his dream house and to excrete enough toxic waste to keep the pipeline running, Mr. Virus needs food. Luckily for him, he's in the Garden of Eden that is the liver, with delectable, tasty delights at his fingertips to keep him and his viral family of cousins strong. He has all the food he needs. How liver cancer forms. Cancer doesn't just appear. There's a complicated underworld constantly evolving inside the liver. Invaders like that virus speed down its streets, and your liver's immune system chases after them. When the virus comes upon a hyper antioxidant from an apple or another liver ally such as red pitaya, it's a red light that sends the virus in the opposite direction. It's a busy city, your liver. Or think of an ant farm. Did you ever have one as a child, or look at one in science class? It gave you a window into an otherwise hidden world, and you could see that the ants were always on the move, their world continually changing. Never again could you look at an anthill the same way, because it was like you had X-ray vision now and could see underground. It's that same perspective that we need to bring to the liver so we can understand what's happening inside of it. Does a liver tumour just appear? No. It takes poisons and a virus for them to spark the process of liver cancer's formation. Here's what I mean. When a mutated virus strain that has the potential to cause cancer enters the liver, it continues to mutate if it has the right toxins to feed on. It takes in toxins and processes them, remanufacturing them to become even more poisonous before excreting them as byproduct into the liver tissue that surrounds it. These more poisonous toxins can then serve as fuel again to any virus cells that come upon them, making their byproduct even more toxic. This creates a continual cycle in which only the strongest virus cells survive and multiply. As this increasingly venomous byproduct saturates an area of liver tissue, it damages it and can even kill it. Benign tumours and cysts can start to form at this point from the dead tissue alone. The virus will also start to feed on dead liver tissue, and since the tissue is saturated with high-octane, remanufactured poison, it will be deadly to a certain number of virus cells. 50 to 70% of the liver's viral load could actually reduce at this point. For these tough-as-nails surviving virus cells, another feeding frenzy will begin. They'll feed on old and new toxins and byproduct in the liver and saturate liver tissue with the even more potent byproduct they excrete, and that will kill off more liver cells, which virus cells will then consume. Because the dead liver cells are more toxic than ever, the surviving virus cells will be that much stronger. This can all occur in slow cycles, on and off, for years, depending on multiple factors that include emotional adrenaline releases and other triggers occurring in someone's life. In the third round of virus cells, feeding on dead liver cells that they've poisoned with even stronger viral byproduct, the result changes a little. This time, virus cells that consume the saturated tissue reach their mutation capacity when faced with its toxicity. Struggling for life, the virus cells produce an enzymatic chemical compound that transforms them into active cancer cells, giving them an afterlife. Newly structured, these viral cancer cells go back to eating the saturated liver tissue, and they reproduce and multiply as cancer. As they do, they'll release a new enzymatic biochemical into surrounding healthy liver tissue, slowly morphing the human cells into cancerous ones too. The cancer cells, both those that used to be viral and those that used to be human, are living, and they group together to survive. In their quest for food, these cancer clusters form tiny blood vessels to draw up nutrients past the microscopic membrane holding them together. The formation of blood vessels is a process called angiogenesis, and as a broad concept, medical science and research have discovered it, though they don't yet understand these specifics. At the same time, there are still active virus cells in the liver that haven't yet gone through as many cycles and reached their mutation capacity yet. They're devouring and eliminating toxins, then devouring and eliminating that poisonous byproduct, and that's continuing to kill off living liver tissue. Through their tiny blood vessels, the cancerous cell masses nearby are sucking up both the byproduct and the dead liver tissue, using them as fuel. And that's how a malignant liver tumor or cyst forms, grows, and expands. Primary, not secondary. Liver cancer is always primary, no matter what else you hear. While medical research and science believe that liver cancer is often secondary, meaning that it metastasizes to the liver after first developing somewhere else in the body, that isn't the truth about how it works. Liver cancer develops directly in the liver through the process we just examined, not from cancer cells spreading from the prostate, lungs, reproductive system, or elsewhere. Viruses love to make their early home in the liver before they end up venturing out and causing